From New York, this is Democracy Now!
At the moment, there are 45 babies between the neonatal intensive care unit and the special intensive care unit. Without a doubt, if the Israeli army occupies this space, every single one of those babies will die.
Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are fleeing Rafah as Israeli airstrikes and shelling hammer the city and Israeli tanks seal the border. We'll go to Rafah for the latest. Then President Biden says he will not supply certain weapons to Israel to be used for an all-out invasion of Rafah.
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. And I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah.
We'll speak with journalist and writer Nathan Thrall. He just won the Pulitzer Prize for his most recent book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. And in India, in the largest election in the world that's underway now, close to a billion people are eligible to vote. We'll speak with the award-winning Indian author Siddharth Deb. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel continues to seal off Gaza's Rafah border crossing as the UN warns it's, quote, choking off the entry of life-saving aid, unquote. The UN adds many of the 600,000 children taking shelter in Rafah are, quote, highly vulnerable and at the edge of survival, unquote. Save the Children also warns humanitarian operations will come to a complete halt unless Israel changes course in Rafah. The aid group says three-quarters of all child patients that have been treated in a so-called safe zone near Rafah have blast injuries. Tens of thousands of Palestinians are once again on the move, though many say their next destination is unknown with no safe place to shelter in Gaza. As Israel prepares for its full-scale ground invasion of Rafah, Palestinians continue to die under aerial attacks.
We were baking bread. We came to blood and martyrs scattered. We're gathering them and body parts in pieces. The civil defense members came and gathered them in pieces. My friend died. They also picked him up in pieces. Everything is in pieces.
In an interview on CNN, President Biden said the U.S. will stop supplying certain weapons to Israel if its forces invade Rafah.
If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
Israel's extreme right national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir posted on X this morning, Hamas hearts Biden. President Biden was in Chicago Wednesday for another campaign fundraiser where he was met with protesters who blocked downtown streets. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, protesting hostage families clashed with police. Two arrests were made. The sister of a hostage was hospitalized. Her mother said in a social media video post, quote, bring back the hostages, stop the war with Hamas. Everywhere in Gaza, health workers uncovered another 49 bodies at the decimated Al-Shifa hospital Wednesday. Most of the bodies were decomposed. Some were found headless. 520 bodies have been uncovered across three Gaza Strip hospitals in recent weeks after attacks and sieges by the Israeli military. Attacking hospitals is a war crime. Israel on Wednesday bulldozed 47 homes of the Palestinian Bedouin community in the Negev Desert, home to some 500 people. Israel's planning on building a highway on the site of the demolished homes, but the approval for the construction has yet to be granted. No alternative housing has been set up for the families who have now been rendered homeless. The Regional Council of Unrecognized Villages of Negev said the demolition was unprecedented in its, quote, scope of destruction and the hatred, unquote. Police have arrested scores more student protesters as part of a widening crackdown on encampments calling on schools to divest from Israel in the United States. At the University of Massachusetts Amherst, police raided a student encampment Tuesday night, arresting around 130. In Washington, D.C., police deployed tear gas as they broke up an encampment at George Washington University. 33 people were arrested. Police also broke up an encampment at the University of Houston. On Capitol Hill, Congressmember Rashida Tlaib held a press conference Wednesday where she praised student protesters.
These students are saying save lives no matter faith or ethnicity.
That's right. Yep.
This is something that I feel like is being completely ignored. Yep. Why are they out there? This is why we're proud. We're proud to use our position in office to bring these voices so you all don't forget why there are encampments, why there are movements in dissent around this country.
Students from George Washington University and other nearby schools joined Tlaib at the news conference. Here in New York City, faculty at the new school have launched the first pro-Palestine faculty encampment to protest the violent police crackdown on their students. The professors named the encampment after the Palestinian poet Rafat Al-Arir, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike in December.
Following police raids and violence, the new school faculty established the Rafat Al-Arir Faculty Solidarity Encampment. The call from students and Palestinians in Gaza is clear. We cannot give up. We must escalate and persevere to demand our universities divest, disclose, and boycott from the war profiteers and institutions justifying and aiding the genocide in Gaza.
Overseas, students at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, have ended their encampment after school officials agreed to divest from blacklisted Israeli companies that have ties to the occupied Palestinian territory. In Spain, the Senate of the University of Barcelona has approved a motion to break institutional and academic ties with Israel. Last month was the Earth's hottest April on record, making it the 11th consecutive month of breaking heat records. Extreme heat has plagued large swaths of Africa and Asia in particular, forcing school closures, destroying crops, and leading to hundreds of heat-related deaths. In Bangladesh, over a million Rohingya refugees living in camps in southeastern Cox's Bazar have been dealing with temperatures as high as 107 degrees Fahrenheit, with few options for cooling down.
This heat is unbearable, especially in our tarp-made homes. During the daytime, it has been difficult to stay inside as the tarp soaks in the heat.
Meanwhile, the UN's International Organization for Migration is warning heavy rains and extreme flooding has created over 200,000 climate refugees over the past week across Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, Somalia, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. Kenya's declared a national day of mourning Friday for the more than 200 people who've died in the country. PowerShift Africa said, quote, "The fossil fuel industry and the politicians that fail to stand up to it have blood on their hands," they said. In other climate news, back here in the United States, lawmakers in Vermont passed a first-of-its-kind bill this week that would make fossil fuel companies pay for destruction caused by climate change. Last summer, Vermont saw historic flooding, which submerged the capital, Montpelier. Damage from the July storm cost the Northeast close to $2.2 billion, according to a federal estimate. In Baltimore, Maryland, the body of the sixth and last missing construction worker killed in the March collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge has been recovered. 37-year-old Jose Minor Lopez was originally from Guatemala. He had two young children. Last week, the body of 49-year-old Miguel Angel Luna Gonzalez was found. The FBI is reportedly looking into whether the massive Dali cargo ship violated a Civil War-era seaman's manslaughter statute when it struck the bridge, causing it to collapse. Here in New York, the family of Wynn Rosario, a 19-year-old from Queens who was killed by police, is demanding accountability for the teenager's death after the release last week of body cam video showing the fatal encounter inside his home. In late March, Wynn called 911 while experiencing a mental health crisis. The NYPD claim Rosario came at them with a pair of scissors when they fatally shot him, but the video shows the teen was on the other side of the kitchen. The officers first repeatedly tased him, then opened fire despite desperate pleas from Rosario's mother, who attempted to shield her son as she urged the officers not to shoot him. The killing has set off protests and intense anger among the Bangladeshi community in Queens. When Rosario's family, elected officials and community leaders spoke at a news conference in front of New York City Hall yesterday to demand justice for Wynn. This is Wynn's brother, Ucho Rosario.
The people that are supposed to serve and protect us are the ones that's killing us. The police were so aggressive and reckless that they could have killed my mom and me, too, in our own house.
Yeah.
If anyone that wasn't a cop did what Alangi and Francesco did, they would have already been in jail.
That's right.
But yet they're still collecting their paycheck from the city like nothing happened.
Wynn's brother and parents also described the NYPD mistreating his family and making them feel like criminals right after the officers killed Wynn. The U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly shot down Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene's attempt to oust fellow Republican Mike Johnson as House Speaker. House Democrats blasted the ongoing GOP Speaker saga, with Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries declaring, quote, Marjorie Taylor Greene and the extreme MAGA Republicans are chaos agents. Separately Wednesday, Speaker Johnson gathered with other Republican lawmakers in front of the Capitol to promote their so-called election integrity bill to stop residents who are not U.S. citizens from voting. Non-citizen voting is extremely rare. There's already a law prohibiting it. Speaker Johnson was joined by far-right figures, including Stephen Miller and Republican lawmakers Chip Roy and Mike Lee, who participated in efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. And in campaign news, independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is facing questions about his health after the New York Times revealed he had a parasitic worm in his brain and was diagnosed with mercury poisoning over a decade ago. In a 2012 divorce deposition, Kennedy admitted he had cognitive problems, including short and long-term memory loss. He said abnormalities observed by doctors in a brain scan were believed to be due to, quote, a worm that got into my brain and ate a portion of it, then died. Kennedy says he has fully recovered from both issues. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Tens of thousands of displaced Palestinians are fleeing Rafah as Israeli airstrikes and shelling hammer the eastern part of the city. Fuel, food, medicine, and other supplies have been cut off following Israel's seizure and closure of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. The main hospital in the area has also been shut down. The World Food Program cannot reach its food warehouse near the Rafah crossing, and aid groups are warning they have only a few days of fuel remaining before humanitarian operations and all hospitals in Gaza begin to shut down. Since Monday, the UN estimates some 80,000 Palestinians have been displaced from Rafah, where over 1.4 million people have sought refuge. Families uprooted multiple times over the past 7 months have nowhere to go. Tent camps in some parts of Rafah have now vanished, springing up again further north along main roads in Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunus. Over the past 24 hours, more than 60 Palestinians were killed across Gaza, many of them in Rafah. The death toll in Gaza over the past 7 months is nearly 35,000, with more than 78,500 wounded.
For more, we go to Rafah, where we're joined by Dorothea Guchardo. She's the director of development of GLIA Project, currently on a medical mission in Gaza, joining us via video stream instead of a live shot outside the Kuwaiti hospital in Rafah, because there's bombing and gunfire in the area, making it dangerous to move. We thank you so much, Dorothea, for joining us. Can you explain what's happening in Rafah right now? I think there is the misconception that unless a full-scale ground invasion happens, there's very little going on. But over the last, 24 hours, about 60 people in Gaza have died, overwhelmingly in Rafah.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry you cut out just a little bit there. The internet here is not so good. The situation on the ground is dire. Everyone here is quite afraid. To say that there's not an incursion in Rafah right now is patently false. Throughout this entire day, I have heard bombs, explosions. I have heard heavy machine gun fire. And it seems to be creeping closer and closer to where we are in central Rafah.
And Dorothea, if you could describe what the situation is in hospitals. You were earlier this week in the last maternity hospital in Gaza, Emirati Hospital. What did you see? If you could describe the situation, the health situation for people in Rafah.
Yeah, the situation in the hospitals is tense. People are really anxious. Patients are worried about where they're going to be able to access healthcare, because as the incursion becomes closer and the threat of the Israeli army approaching the hospitals becomes more real, patients are afraid to go to the hospitals. Doctors themselves are...
Dorothea Guichardo has...
Go ahead, Dorothea.
Occasionally you freeze, but just keep going. I mean, this is incredible that we're able to speak to you there.
Right. Thank you. The healthcare providers are afraid to come into work. They are moving their families from East Rafah to West Rafah to the coast. So access to healthcare providers is lessening as the threat of invasion looms. 20 years of blockade in the Gaza Strip means that the healthcare sector was already low resource. This is exacerbated by this depraved war that Palestinians have been living through for the past 7 months.
And what are the medical supplies that people are working with? I mean, we've just heard that there's very little fuel remaining and there isn't much time before all hospitals in Gaza, of course, including in Rafah, begin to shut down. And I assume the situation in Rafah is worse. If you could explain what you know of what's happening in hospitals elsewhere and what the threats to hospitals in Rafah in particular are now, for how long can they continue to operate even minimally?
Even minimally, if no fuel comes in, we're looking at a maximum of 3 days. 3 days of fuel to supply these hospitals to maintain any level of healthcare. The situation is beyond dire. There are ongoing plans to try to bring Nasser Hospital back into working condition. You'll recall that Nasser was besieged by the Israelis a few times. This is where the mass graves were uncovered. It is not ready yet. So if we take a look at the NICU in particular, it has 5 incubators, and it has no staff. There's no capacity to bring any children that are in the hospital in Emirati, in Rafah, to Nasser for any kind of care. It's just not functional yet. So it's devastating.
So you're talking about fuel. There's also, of course, medical equipment, food that's not getting in. And what about workers, healthcare workers? We've interviewed so many doctors who've gone into Gaza to help. If the border area is closed with the Israeli military moving in and seizing control of the Gaza side of Gaza side of the Rafah border.
So we had been entering through the Rafah border since early January, all of the medical teams that were coming in to work in the hospitals. Those delegations brought with them medical supplies, medicine, equipment, anything that they would need to perform their duties, anything that we could do to plug the holes in the sinking ship. It was the most reliable way to get anything inside of Gaza, and that has been completely cut off. No humanitarian workers can come in. No additional aid is coming in. And in fact, no humanitarian workers can go out. And that's also problematic because people are burning out and we need to be able to replenish our support.
And Dorothea, as we mentioned earlier, you were to join us outside the Kuwaiti hospital where we had an AP live shot set up, but you weren't able to get there because of bombing and gunfire. What's the situation outside other hospitals? And is Kuwaiti hospital functioning at all? And if so, at what level? How are people medical personnel able to get in and out if that's the situation, if it's so risky and dangerous in that area?
So you did cut out just a little bit, but I'm assuming you're asking how we're moving when the situation is so volatile. We are moving on an emergent need basis. So the hospitals absolutely require assistance in terms of staffing. We've made the decision to continue staffing these hospitals that we are that we have been working with, because our presence there gives them some measure of encouragement and some measure of hope. And so we're continuing to supply whatever services we can while we can, while at the same time monitoring the situation. So we're literally taking it hour by hour.
And is it at all possible now, Dorothea, for wounded patients to go anywhere, wounded patients in Rafah to go anywhere for a better, I suppose, a medical treatment?
Their only options are to go up toward Khan Yunis, where Nasser Hospital, European Hospital, and Al-Aqsa Hospital are located. These are understaffed, overwhelmed. Nasser is non-functional. And let's not forget the patients that are requiring life-saving surgeries that would require them to be evacuated out of Gaza. They cannot leave. 2 days ago, I watched a baby die that had swelling around its brain. It required a particular kind of surgery that simply could not be done here in Gaza, and the request couldn't be fulfilled because the Israelis have taken the Rafah crossing.
And what about the stream of humanity, Palestinians who are being told they have to leave areas of Rafah right now? Where are they going? Do you see people on the move for what, the first, the second, the third, the fourth time, as they already came to Rafah and are already displaced?
Sorry, you cut out just a little bit there. Yes, we're seeing a mass displacement of people. This is a population that has been, on average, displaced at least three times. And to my knowledge, that's the first time this has ever happened in any area of the world. The people in East Rafah are trying to move, but do consider that many of them can't afford it. With fuel being so expensive, it's difficult for them to afford a vehicle to even bring their belongings. So you're seeing some in donkey carts. You're seeing people moving with things in hand because they just have no other way of shifting from where they are into a supposed safe zone. Because let's make it very clear, there is no safe zone in Gaza. Every single area of Gaza is subject to attack.
Dorothea Guicciardo, we thank you so much for being with us. We are just very relieved we could speak to you and that you're okay. Director of Development of GLIA Project, currently on a medical mission in Gaza, speaking to us from Rafah. Coming up, we'll be joined by, the now Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nathan Thrall. His book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. He's usually in Jerusalem. Today, he'll join us from Berlin, Germany. Stay with us.
I wait for you in heaven on this perfect string of love and drink your soup of magpies in a pottery bowl that looks as I am now, brown, round and warm. Chime on.
Fortunately Gone by The Breeders, engineered by Steve Albini. The seminal musician and recording engineer died Tuesday at the age of 61 of a heart attack. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
President Biden has said for the first time he would not supply certain weapons to Israel to be used for an all-out invasion of Rafah. Biden's comments came after his administration's decision last week to pause a shipment of heavy bombs to Israel, while at the same time approving another $827 million for other weapons and equipment to the Israeli military. In an interview on CNN Wednesday, Biden responded to a question about the pause transfer of 2,000-pound bombs and was asked whether those bombs have been used by Israel to kill civilians in Gaza. He was also asked whether Israel's attacks on Rafah have crossed a red line. He was interviewed by CNN's Aaron Burnett.
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. And I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently.
but it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
So, just to understand what they're doing right now in Rafah, is that not going into Rafah as you define it?
No, they haven't gone into the population centers. What they did is right on the border. And it's causing problems with right now in terms of with Egypt, which I've worked very hard to make sure we have a relationship and help. But I've made it clear to Bibi in the War Cabinet, they're not going to get our support if, in fact, they go in these population centers. We're not walking away from Israel's security. We're walking away from Israel's ability to wage war in those areas.
So it's not over your red line yet?
Not yet.
President Biden's comments come as his administration has delayed issuing a report to determine whether Israel's violated U.S. and international law in its war on Gaza. For more, we're joined by the Jerusalem-based journalist and writer Nathan Thrall. He just won the Pulitzer Prize this week for his most recent book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, which tells the story of Israel's occupation of the West Bank through one family's tragedy. He's also the author of The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine. Nathan is joining us today from Berlin, Germany. Welcome to Democracy Now! So, Nathan, if you can start off by responding to President Biden's comments, saying that the shipment of 2,000-pound bombs is being delayed because they don't want them to be used in Gaza. This doesn't relate to the emergency funding for Israeli military that he just signed off on, but it is highly significant. Can you talk about what this means for Israel and the rage of Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir and others? Ben-Gavir just posting, Biden hearts Hamas.
Thank you, Amy. It's too little too late. It is a step in the right direction, but the administration has said that it has not made a final determination even about these paused weapons. Biden said something very important. It's wrong. He also said something important months ago, which is that Israel is bombing indiscriminately, and it's doing that indiscriminate bombing with U.S. weapons. So it is very simple for Biden to end this and to have ended this a long time ago. And it's not by threatening to pause a small portion of the weapons that are coming in. Very early in this war, Israel could not continue to conduct it without resupply from the United States. The United States is fully complicit. I am a U.S. taxpayer, and I am paying to kill Palestinian civilians.
So, Nathan, if you've just mentioned, ending the war, and there was a possibility a ceasefire proposal earlier this week was accepted by Hamas in a move that was that surprised many, including Israel, the ceasefire, which was negotiated, put together by Egypt and Qatar. And just days earlier, before Hamas accepted the ceasefire on April 29th, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, had said the proposal was, quote, quite extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel, and that Hamas was the only obstacle to a ceasefire. And Israel has now said that the proposal falls far short of its demands, but it's continuing its negotiations in Cairo. So if you could tell us what you think the main points of contention are and how much that proposal changed from the one that Israel had initially approved and this one that Hamas has agreed to.
So the fundamental obstacle in all of these ceasefire negotiations has been one central issue, and that is that Hamas has demanded that the hostage exchange be accompanied by an end to the war, and Israel has refused. It says it wants to get the hostages back and to do a prisoner exchange with Hamas and then to continue pummeling Gaza. Hamas and any other party in its place would be insane to accept such a deal. It is the only leverage they have, and they cannot afford to agree to a ceasefire, a so-called ceasefire, that has them relinquish the only asset that they have that Israel wants without a commitment that this is an end to the war. And so the fundamental issue is that Hamas says that the proposal that was given to it does entail an end to the war, a full, sustainable calm that's guaranteed by the United States and other mediators. And Israel says it rejects that. And we have seen the text of the proposal that Hamas has accepted. It is very close to what has been reported on all of the negotiations over the past week. And we haven't seen the text that Israel says slightly differs in wording.
Can you talk about what's going on the ground in Israel? I mean, we just reported that last night hostage families clashed with police in Tel Aviv. Two people were arrested. One sister of a hostage was hospitalized. Her mother said, end the war with Hamas. How significant is this movement of hostage families and all their allies? And is that putting pressure on Netanyahu? Do you think he is going to actually engage in this wholesale ground assault on Rafah?
The protests for a hostage exchange deal are a tremendous pressure on the government. And if they grow in size, they will make the current coalition and Netanyahu sweat even more. So they are very significant. You know, as we have seen, they are not sufficient yet to have gotten Israel to agree to a ceasefire proposal. And so far, Biden's limited threat has not been enough either.
So, Nathan, just to, you know, you have lived in Jerusalem and in Israel for many years, over a decade. We last spoke to you just days before the October 7th attack. If you could begin by talking about your response to Hamas's attack and then what's unfolded since, whether you were surprised by this, by either the scale of the Hamas attack, and then, of course, what Israel has unleashed on Gaza.
Yeah, the book tour that I was on began, you know, several days before October 7th, and I was actually in the U.S. and on Democracy Now! With the title character, Abed Salama. He and I had returned from an event on Friday night, and we got the news late that night as it was early morning, Saturday morning, in Israel-Palestine, and we were both utterly shocked, and we realized that the entire atmosphere that would be, first of all, the entire atmosphere that his family is living in was about to change radically, and his entire community was locked down immediately, and that the whole region was going to change, not to mention the fact that there would be much more hostility toward the message of this book, and that it would be much more difficult for us to speak. And indeed, many of our events were canceled after October 7th.
And Nathan, could you situate, of course, you've just mentioned your book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. If you could talk about that book, what prompted it, and situate it in the context of what we've seen in the last several months.
Yeah. So, you know, the genesis of the book was really a place of frustration for me in working on Israel-Palestine for many years and watching as a heightened period of violence, like a war in Gaza, immediately brings Israel-Palestine into the news. It mobilizes students and it gets the attention of the world. And leaders around the world invariably call for a restoration of calm. And what I wanted to write about in this book was that so-called calm, which is anything but calm for Palestinians. It's a system of domination that is extremely bureaucratic and elaborate and has lasted for over half a century. And it is not going anywhere. And so long as we are only seeing bloodshed, periodic bloodshed, and calling for a restoration of the so-called calm that existed before that bloodshed, we are doomed to see that bloodshed repeat. And my intention was to choose something seemingly commonplace, like a bus accident involving a group of Palestinian kindergartners, to describe this system of control and how ordinary people, Palestinians and Jews, living in this area, both navigate through the system that's controlling them and also implement and create this system. And so the idea was to bring our attention to this deeply, deeply unjust system that is fully supported by the United States and its Western allies.
And what was happening, Nathan, in the West Bank prior to October 7th, and now the number of people who've been killed since, killed and arrested, the Palestinians, since October 7th?
Prior to October 7th, we had already seen a spike in aggressive behavior from the army and armed settlers in the West Bank. The UN issued a small report at the end of September talking about unprecedented levels of forced displacement of Palestinian Bedouin. And it said that roughly 1,100 Palestinian Bedouin had been displaced in the last year and a half. In the period immediately after October 7th, while all the eyes of the world were on Gaza, an even greater number, more than 1,200 in just the weeks after October 7th, more than 1,200 Palestinian Bedouin were displaced in the West Bank. There has been a surge in violence. There have been hundreds of Palestinians who have been killed. Huge numbers who have been arrested, many of them held without trial or charge under so-called administrative detention, which can be held for up to 6 months and then renewed indefinitely. And in general, the restrictions on movement in the West Bank are the worst that they have ever been since the occupation began. It now takes me hours to get to locations that took me a half hour or 40 minutes in the past. All of the jobs, virtually all of them, in the settlements and in Israel, which so many Palestinian extended families depend on, these are the higher paying jobs for Palestinians in the West Bank, those have all but disappeared. And so Palestinians are strangled economically. They are strangled with in terms of their movement. I just went a few weeks ago to a dinner, an iftar dinner at Abed Salama's home, and his brother, who his entire family lives in Annatha, his brother lives in Ramallah, and he said he had not left Ramallah since October 7th because the restrictions on movement and also because of the unsafety, the settler attacks and all of the violence that is happening in the West Bank while the world's attention is focused on Gaza.
And so, Nathan, explain. You've said why are all the discussions about a one-state or two-state solution as the possible resolution to this? Why do you think those conversations
are... I can't hear anything. I'm sorry.
We've lost audio. We're going to go to a music break, unless Nathan breaks in and says he can hear us. And then we'll come back, and then we're going to talk about the largest election in the world, India. We're talking to Nathan Thrall. He's speaking to us from Berlin, Germany, though he's usually based in Jerusalem. He's back. So, Nermeen, why don't you finish your question?
Nathan, I was asking you about why you think the discussions around a two-state or one-state solution are the wrong discussions to be happening.
You know, these conversations are premised on the notion that Israel eventually has to choose. It has to either give the millions of Palestinians living under its control without basic civil rights, it has to give them either citizenship with equality or statehood. And so many people in the diplomatic community would like to have, as they have been having for decades, debates about what a two-state outcome should look like, whether there should be two states or one state or confederation or what have you. And all of that is an enormous distraction from the reality on the ground, because the fact is of the matter is Israel does not have to choose between two states and one state. It doesn't have to choose between giving Palestinians sovereignty or citizenship. It has a third option, which is to continue on the path that it's going down. The path that it's going down is a slow de facto annexation of the West Bank, an absorption of the West Bank settlements in Area C, a takeover of Palestinian land, and a constriction of Palestinians into small, walled-off or fenced-off communities like the town of Annata, where my book takes place, or like Gaza. And so rather than focusing on the reality, which is a movement in the opposite direction of either two states or equality in one state, but rather a deepening of the system of control that leading human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the UN Human Rights Council and Al-Haq and B'Tselem have all described as a system of apartheid, rather than addressing that system, Israel would very much like for everybody to debate what would be the ideal outcome. What is the future utopia that we would all like? And let's only address this structural inequality, this systematic domination, once we've all agreed that we've landed on the right perfect outcome.
Nathan, before we go, we were remiss in not congratulating you on the Pulitzer Prize this week for your book. When you came here, it was
Thank you very much.
It was 2 days before October 7th. Your book had just come out. You had events up the wazoo. So many of them were canceled. And you're in Berlin right now in Germany. Germany has been a remarkable scene where you have German police arresting Jewish protesters saying that they cannot criticize Israel. What has happened with your events from Germany to the United States as you raise questions about Israel's war on Gaza?
In Germany, I had an event that was to take place on Tuesday in Frankfurt that was canceled at the very last minute by the Union International Club in Frankfurt. And none of the people who canceled the event had read the book or knew a thing about it, and none of them had or provided any substantive reason for the cancellation. And the same thing was happening to me in the United States. And the reason in Germany is everybody is afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism. And what they're really being accused of is not anti-Semitism, but criticism of Israel that is described as anti-Semitism. And Israel has spent years, Israel and its allies have spent years in the United States and in Germany, putting forward a definition of anti-Semitism that includes criticism of Israel, entirely legitimate criticism of Israel, and trying to get around our basic democratic commitment to free speech by describing speech that is entirely legitimate as anti-Semitic. And so that's what's happened here. And who, of course, is the close ally of Israel, the most pro-Israel force here in Germany? It's the far right party. As we see elsewhere, ethno-nationalists love Israel as a model for the kind of place they want to become, an ethno-national state that will dominate over people who are not like them.
Nathan Thrall, again, congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize today for your book. We're speaking to you in Berlin, Germany. You're headed back to Jerusalem, where you usually live. Awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his most recent book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. To see our hour with them on Democracy Now!, Abed Salama and Nathan Thrall, right after the book was published, you can go to democracynow.org. Coming up, the largest election in the world is underway now in India. Close to a billion people are eligible to vote. We'll speak with the award-winning Indian journalist Siddharth Deb. Stay with us. Charikala Sunny Singh here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Millions of voters in India are casting their ballots in the third phase of the country's mammoth general election. Voting began on April 19th in a seven-phase election, which is taking place over a month and a half. Nearly a billion people are eligible to vote. Ballots are set to be counted on June 4th. Among those who cast their ballots on earlier this week was incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is seeking a rare third straight term in office. The election pits Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party against an alliance of more than two dozen opposition parties led by the Indian National Congress. Modi's opponents have accused him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as, quote, infiltrators, prompting the Congress party to file a formal complaint against Modi with election authorities. Voter turnout in this year's election has declined compared to the 2019 vote.
For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Siddharth Deb, award-winning Indian author and journalist born in Northeast India. His most recent novel is The Light at the End of the World. His new nonfiction book is Twilight Prisoners, The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. He's a professor of literary studies at the New School in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the release of the book. Let's start off by talking about this mammoth election, the biggest in the world, even if it may not be as much turnout even as 2019. Can you talk about what's at stake and whether Narendra Modi is expected to win by as huge a margin as was predicted?
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be back here. Thank you. Nice to see you again, Narmeen. I think, it's hard to make these predictions, but it seems very likely that it is not, as we can see from the declining voter participation. We can also see from Narendra Modi sort of anting up the hate speech that there is a kind of concern within the Hindu right, within the BJP, that it's not going to be as sweeping as 2019 or 2014. And that's partly because, the Hindu right have delivered on all the things, all the big promises they had made, which are basically based on hatred and demonization of Muslims. There's really no agenda for actual development. There is really no agenda for, public health, people's security. Things are tremendously precarious on a day-to-day level at India for people. And we can see that beginning to trickle in even among the supporters. Is it going to be enough to prevent him from the Hindu right from winning the elections this time? Probably not. But yes, I do think there is a kind of, they sense that things are changing. And you can also tell because, you can see people. That's why he's been brought up the whole Ghuspetia. That's the word for infiltrators that they have used for a long time. That he's trying to, it's the same rhetoric, but they're just trying to increase the amount of it, basically.
So if you could explain, Siddharth, your book is called, Twilight Prisoners, and the subtitle is The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. So if you could explain what exactly you think has happened under successive Modi regimes, just before, as India was getting ready for the elections, the World Inequality Lab came out with a study titled The Rise of the Billionaire Raj, which shows that income inequality in India is worse than it was under British colonial rule. So, as against what most people think about India shining and India rising, what's happening in India?
Well, Narmeen, you're absolutely right. It is worse than under colonial rule, and that is saying something. Because when the British left the Indian subcontinent, I believe the average life expectancy was 26. It was that kind of inequality. And Modi's regime has basically empowered a small set of oligarchs, basically. But again, in terms of everyday life for people, there's a tremendous amount of precariousness. There's a tremendous amount of food insecurity. We saw in the handling, for instance, of the pandemic, which the Hindu right is trying to spin, but we saw how abysmal Modi's and the Hindu right's handling of the pandemic was. And it was not just the poor that suffered. It was the middle class, even the well-to-do in India were scrambling for oxygen tanks and hospital beds in some of the most expensive hospitals in India. So that's the kind of chaos that Modi has, you know, presided over. There's been a tremendous upward transfer of wealth. And again, it is beginning to show through. The cracks are beginning to become visible, even to his core supporters, I think.
And also at the level, Siddharth, that's obviously social indicators, mm-hmm. which are very important. Mm-hmm. But also at the political level, at the level of altering India's orientation, in particular towards Muslims, but to minorities in general, if you could speak specifically about this Partition Horrors Remembrance Day, who that's directed towards, who experienced these horrors. And then second, you've actually been to Ayodhya, where the Babri Masjid was destroyed in 1992, and where earlier this year, the Ram Mandir was built. If you could speak about the significance of both these things.
So, you know, just to connect, in some sense, you know, the Hindu right in India are trying to create an ethno-nationalist state. And that's one of the reasons, and it's really ironic, one of the great ironies of history, that the Hindu right is modeled explicitly after the Italian fascists and the Nazis. And now they are great allies of Israel. And for the same reasons, they admire this idea of a strong, muscular, militant majority that are the only people who have the right to this nation. And the minorities must be dominated, must be brutalized or expelled. And that is what the Hindu Rights Project has been. And the main platforms of it, for symbolic reasons, to rouse up this sort of, you know, national, to create this, concoct this Hindu identity. One of the platforms has been to, you know, has been to build the temple. And this goes back to the BJP's rise as a political party and the demolition of the Babri Masjid in 1992. And so, yes, I was there in 2021 to report on the construction of the temple and built, you know, there is no evidence that a Hindu temple actually had existed underneath this mosque. There's no archaeological evidence. But the thing is that, you know, Modi and the Hindu right seize on these symbolic things as opposed to substantive things, because the substantive things are food security, public health, climate collapse. You just had the report on Bangladesh. My mother's in Calcutta. The heat in Bengal is incredible. So there's no discussion of these substantial questions. There is just the enriching of the oligarchs. And for this quote-unquote, this notional Hindu majority, there are these symbolic issues. We will give you a Ram temple to avenge the humiliation of the Muslims because the Muslims are outsiders, again, quote-unquote, in this Hindu right mind. But, you know, when I went to Ayodhya, yes, there is this giant million-dollar temple complex being built, gargantuan, on a very sleepy little pilgrimage town, actually. But, you know, if you walk around, the roads are waterlogged, it's muddy, there is people are tremendously impoverished, there is an incredible gender disparity. You barely see any women on the streets. It is such a masculine, violent, patriarchal kind of, you know, project that they're pushing forward. And that's what we are seeing again and again in India.
India is currently the largest importer of Israeli weapons in the world.
Yes.
Narendra Modi banned from the United States for years, yes, after the Gujarat massacre. Yes. He was the equivalent of the governor of Gujarat at the time. The significance, yes, of this, the going chiefest, right through to the election now, you have his opponents accusing him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as, quote, infiltrators, the opposition Congress Party. Filing a formal complaint against him with election authorities. The significance of all this happening now, would you say he is getting more extreme? And what about the U.S. relationship with India?
Oh, you know, Amy, he's not getting more extreme. He has always, and it's not just Modi, the Hindu right, they've always been extreme. They have been extreme. So to go back to Narmin's question of the Partition Horrors Museum, they were extreme even in 1947 when the partition took place. And I take great offense. My father was a refugee from the partition of what became Bangladesh. Modi is just weaponizing this completely one-sided. The Hindu right participated gleefully in the massacres and the rapes that accompanied the partition. Everybody suffered. Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Dalits. People suffered on a very large scale. And they are simply weaponizing it into this sort of this, again, this notion that the Muslims are the villains and the Hindus are these perfect victims. And that's not true. But you know, we see this in terms of the U.S. relations. Every U.S. administration we have seen since that initial rejection of a visa for Modi when he was the chief minister of Gujarat under 2002, once Modi won the elections in 2014, once he became the prime minister, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the Biden administration, every single administration has embraced Modi, has embraced the Hindu right, and looked the other way in spite of these egregious violations of human rights and utter violence. So in that sense, he hasn't become more extreme. I was in Assam reporting for the New York Times Magazine. I have seen Modi's Home Minister Amit Shah come down in a helicopter to a rally and talk about Muslims as ghuspaitias or the word infiltrators. You know, it's on record. They have been doing it again and again. People are compared to ants and crows. That's what they are. This is genocidal language. And the U.S. has stood aside. And yes, India is the largest arms importer in the world, and not just a purchase of arms from Israel, but also from the United States and from Britain and from France, all the great Western democratic powers.
And so that, before we end, if you could just say how you understand Modi's change in policy, India's change in policy vis-a-vis Israel, because for decades after partition, yes, India was totally pro-Palestinian.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's partly also, you know, this has not been very hard for me to think about. I mean, I was for Palestinian rights. That was part of my political formation growing up as a teenager in India, because, you know, India's own experience of colonialism, which was horrific, it just made it very, very clear that we would be for Palestine, but without ever marginalizing the suffering of Jews, not just in the Shoah, but centuries of European anti-Semitism. These were part and parcel of our anti-colonial identity. It's for the same reason that we were against apartheid South Africa. It was for the same reason that we were for civil rights in the United States. And now, it is basically a coming together of these ethno-nationalist muscular states that admire each other. And that's what the Hindu right is, and that's what the Israel is, and the United States supports them both.
And we just have 10 seconds, but you're a professor at the New School. The New School has just set up a faculty encampment, maybe the first in the country, to defend the students, the significance of this.
I absolutely find it amazing. I think the students have been incredibly inspiring. We would not have found out about the New School's complicity in Israeli weapons manufacturing in the war. And the students have actually made that clear. And so, yes, it's our duty as faculty in a place that touts social justice to stand with them.
Siddharth Deb, award-winning Indian journalist, born in Northeast India. His latest book is called Twilight Prisoners.